What we're talking about is essentially the following. Well, I think it's a good example of bound states at the LHC. Or we can find other interpretations here as well. So we'll be talking about exactly this situation, like in that picture, that we produce two colored particles as a pair. And if the QCD potential between them is attractive, they can form bound states if they're produced close to threshold. And the interesting thing about it is that the bound state can decay by the annihilation of two particles back into some standard mole particles, rather than the decays of the constituent particles the way they would decay anyway. And this gives us a new signature for a new physics. So in this talk, our example will be the MSSM, and we'll talk about all the bound states that are possible in the MSSM. But everything that I do will be pretty general, and I will mostly concentrate not on particular numbers for particular MSSM scenarios, but on what really goes into this question of when the bound states can give us new information, what this information is. So bound states in other theories will also, in a sense, include in this talk. Sometimes I will mention them explicitly, but sometimes you will just see that things that I say are pretty general. The most detailed analysis we'll do on the gluinonium, which is a bound state of two gluinos, and the prospects for its detection at the LHC. So first, a brief introduction about what kind of bound states I'm going to talk about. And the bound states are going to be very similar to the hydrogen atom. So to set up the notation, I will remind you about the hydrogen atom. We have this Coulomb potential. The binding energy of the ground state is given as such, the Bohr radius, and the wave function of the ground state at the origin. Now, what bound states are we talking about? We're talking about bound states of two colored particles that are attracted to each other by exchange of gluons. The potential will have exactly the same form, just that the fine structure constant will be replaced by the strong coupling constant times a number that will depend on the color of our particles. In particular, this number depends in the following way on the Casimirs of the representations of these two particles, and on the Casimir of the bound states. If the bound state, for example, is a color singlet, then this is zero, and we have positive C, which means we'll have attractive potential between the particles. Of course, this simple picture assumes very reasonable assumptions for heavy particles that we expect to produce at the LHC, that the Bohr radius, which is essentially determined by this expression and by analogous expression for the QCD bound states. We want it to be much smaller than QCD scale, so the confinement is not important. We also want alpha s to be perturbative, so that the higher order corrections are also not very important. And we want the non-relativistic limit, which means that the velocity, like the velocity here in the hydrogen atom, should be small. And these approximations are rather good. And then this is the picture that we have. And all the expressions from the hydrogen atom, we will be using them just by obvious substitution of here. So what kind of particles are we going to produce? So here is an example in the MSSM. We have this strong interaction diagrams in which you start with the quarks or gluons, and you can produce, for example, in these diagrams, you produce a quark anti-quark pair. Here you produce a quark of you produce a pair of gluinos. Here you produce a quark and a gluino, and here a pair of quarks. In principle, all these particles, when you produce the pair, they can have attraction between them. And you can think whether bound states exist. So if we look at the color configurations, then the quark anti-quark pair can be a singlet or an octet. And for a singlet, the potential is attractive. For the octet, it is repulsive. So we can talk about singlet bound states. For gluinos, bound states can be color singlet, or they can also be color octets, or the distinction between these two octets is whether the gluinos are symmetric or antisymmetric in color. In these two situations, we again have certain color configurations in which the potential is attractive. Now, why are the bound states good? Because if we don't form a bound state, then the two particles are typically decaying into multiple particles or jets and missing energy. And reconstruction of these processes is usually complicated and involves various uncertainties. And it's hard to get information about these new particles that we produced. On the other hand, like I mentioned, when we have a bound state, the two particles can annihilate into two standard mole particles. And this signature is much easier to reconstruct. Of course, even when the particles do form a bound state, they can still decay on their own, like here. And if this happens, then we don't enjoy the benefits of the bound state. So we'll need to check in which scenarios the bound states indeed decay predominantly by the annihilation rather than by the decays of the constituent particles. How do we do computation that involve bound states? It's very simple. If you want to find the matrix element for example, production or annihilation of a bound state, so we have two incoming particles and a bound state, it's the same matrix element like for a production of the pair of particles as free particles times the wave function of the bound state at the origin. This can be shown very easily by asking what is the matrix element for producing these two particles where the momenta are distributed according to the wave function of the state that we are interested in. And since the matrix element doesn't depend very much on the momenta within the wave function, then when we integrate over the momenta, we get just the wave function, the value of the wave function in position space at the origin. This is explained in Pesky and Schroeder, for example. You can also see how exactly you get this factor of the mass here. Yeah, so the size of the bound state, let me just go a little bit back here to the first slide. The Bohr radius of the bound state is given by essentially alpha s times the mass of the particle. So they will be, imagine alpha s, for example, something like 0.1. So if you have particle of certain mass, then the scale of the inverse Bohr radius will be roughly by a factor of 10 smaller. And also, maybe I should mention here, Yeah. So, for example, if the two particles are identical particles with mass m, like I assumed here, then I replaced the mass of the electron by half the mass of the particle. Yeah, this is how I got this expression. The two here comes from the half. Yeah, you're right. I took the reduced mass into account. And also, maybe I should point out that I'd note this alpha s as alpha s bar to say that alpha s should be evaluated at the scale of the Bohr radius rather than at the scale of the mass of the particle. It can have some significant effect because here, for example, an expression for the square of the wave function at the origin, we get alpha s bar cubed. So alpha s bar will always denote this alpha s that we have in the potential, and alpha s will denote its value at the scale of the mass of the particle. OK, so this is how we can compute the bound states. Another more sophisticated formalism that will not really be needed for bound states that we care about, but it gives you much more insight into what is going on, is using the non-relativistic propagator. where a variable x here is the distance between the two particles. If you solve this equation without a delta function, you get just the energy levels of radial excitations, like in the hydrogen atom. But this Green's function gives you essentially the propagator. The solution looks like this. The first term is just the contribution of the continuum above the threshold. But here, this term includes the effects of the bound states. The denominator vanishes here at this energies En, the energies of all the radial excitations. And this formalism is actually important if the particles have large widths. It is correct to replace the energy by energy plus I gamma, where gamma is the width of the single particle. And this will incorporate this effect. But if the width is small, then the imaginary part of the Green's function, to which the production will be proportional, actually reduces to just the single particle phase space, this kind of the delta function, at the mass of the bound state, which is essentially 2m minus the binding energy, times the square of the wave function at the origin, exactly like in this kind of formalism. Now, when the width is important, we get something more general than this. And let me show you some pictures so that you will see more clearly. Yeah, so the width here is the width of the individual particle, of one of them. So if, as we will see soon, the annihilation rates, for example, are very small, then the width of the bound state will be twice this width. If the annihilation rates are the dominant mechanism of bound state decay, then this will be included in this gamma 2. So the Green's function, in principle, it works for any potential. The solution I wrote here is for a Coulomb potential. I mean, the method will work also when you include the corrections, the potential, and this is not included here. But let me show you. I don't want to confuse you with the Green's function. Instead, I will show you some picture how this Green's function looks like and how you really see the bound state.
The Coulomb point of the potential. That's actually a strong constraint from where you are on the potential space. Are you using that at all, or are you just saying that it's just going to be Coulombic?
So I'm saying that it's going to be Coulombic because we're talking about a very heavy particle where alpha s is very small and we are very far from the confinement scale. So it is justified, at least as a rough approximation for very heavy particles, a good approximation to assume that the potential is Coulombic.
Only if you're not far down in the well, though.
So we care about the value of the potential at the scales over which the wave function has some support. So within the distance of our bound state, if the wave function does not spread out too much, large distances, which are much larger than the Bohr radius, which it is not, of course,
then we don't care. So you're assuming extremely shallow bound states, right?
I assume bound states like the hydrogen atom. What do you mean extremely shallow? You're saying the value of n. You're saying that if n is large, then... Yeah, so actually, bound states with the large values of n will not contribute too much, as we will see. For example, the square of the wave function at the origin goes like 1 over n cubed. So essentially, we don't really care what happens for a large n, and on the small n, we'll make the dominant contribution.
So was the question actually whether everyone exchange gives a Coulomb potential or not?
That's another problem.
So for very small separation.
Yeah, so he's just making assumptions, implicit assumptions about the kinematic. Basically about the configuration he's interested in.
Well, he's explicitly said that Bohr radius had to be small for QCD scale, so you're in the Coulomb region. And you're supposed to be fine.
I think that always, I mean, that doesn't dictate that you're just in the Coulomb region, right? The Coulomb region satisfies that condition, but there's other regions in the potential that don't satisfy that condition.
The wave function is not sensitive to the other regions.
Maybe you worry about the the speed is big compared to the binding energy?
Yeah. Is it also usually when you do like things in NRQCD, you should make explicit relationships between your velocity and your alpha.
Well, he did. He said he had a B-squared reserve order, for B was a order of alpha.
Okay, let me show you some interesting curves. Somehow the screen changed the resolution of my Mathematica. Let me try to fix it this way. Let me show you what this Green's function actually means. What I showed here is a parton level cross section for two gluons going into TT bar as a function of the center of mass energy, where zero energy means exactly the production threshold. In other words, when the two gluons have the energy to produce a pair of free top quarks, this is zero. So what do we see here? We see that the production cross section doesn't vanish at threshold, but there is some contribution even below threshold. We even see this sign of a resonance. But the resonance is not very clear. And the reason for this is that when we're talking about TT bar pair, the width of the top is very, very large compared to the binding energy, or it is comparable to the binding energy. But we will also have bound states that the width there is much smaller. So let me show you what happens as I change the width in this picture. But I will.
Cross section down there means.
Yeah, so I will explain this now. So this is the production cross section, and this is the cross section for the process that we are kind of interested in. This is the annihilation process in which you produce a TT bar pair, and it annihilates into glue glue. So we don't really see too much of the resonance also in this cross section, but we will see in a moment that it becomes very large when the bound state becomes narrow. You see, we also have not only the first bound state, but the radial excitation also appears now.
Width is compared to the
yeah, yeah. So the width here on the scale is between 0 and 3 GeV. And so we want to compare the width to the binding energy. And the binding energy is distance from the bound state up to here. Yeah, so the binding energy is like 1.5 GeV. And the twice the top width is 2.6 GeV. And now I made the width smaller, and we really see this bound states appearing. And we also see that there is a strong annihilation signal coming from the bound state. And I already multiplied this by a factor of 50, but it is still very strong and it will become even bigger as I make the bound state narrow. These two curves, the continuum contribution, they haven't changed. So before, we had something like this. Of course, part of it, when the limit when the bound state becomes very narrow, we can just talk about the branching ratio for annihilation and the single top decays. And of course, as I make the single top width smaller, the annihilation cross-section will be higher. But as you see, this is the regime in which we are interested in which bound states are very narrow, because then we have the strong annihilation signal. And this is why we will not really need all this Green's function formalism. Instead, we'll just be using this factor of the wave function at the origin. One last thing that I want to show you in this picture is what happens when we turn off the attraction. So I'm bringing the attraction down. The bound states start disappearing. And we have just the result that we would have without the attraction, that the production vanishes at threshold, and it is suppressed proportional to beta, the velocity at the region near the threshold. let me just compare this to the original situation that we had. In the original situation, we have this enhanced production above the threshold. This is just the usual Sommerfeld enhancement, like has been mentioned a lot recently in relation to the dark matter models. And we also have the bound state. Question?
What happens in an environment where you've got some distribution of these things started off? What's the likelihood of finding the original PD bar being produced with relative velocity small enough to be bound? This is kind of saying that given that I'm in a you're focusing on the energy window, but you really kind of smear this over the initial production distribution functions. And how likely is it that you're going to get a bound state?
So, of course, this is not an observable quantity. To get an observable quantity, you need to convolute this with the partial distribution functions. And this small feature will still remain that small, and we will essentially not be able to see a bound state of TT bar quark in essentially any of the channels. We instead will probably see just the onset of the continuum contribution that will start a little bit earlier, and it's not clear whether we will be able to really measure sufficiently precisely. This is why these kind of bound states are not very interesting. But when the bound state becomes very narrow, then all these effects of the smearing will not be important at all, because, for example, if we look at the annihilation signal, there is no contribution from the continuum at all. So all the contribution, doesn't matter how small or large your resolution cell is, everything will be coming from the bound state.
So I'm thinking the natural scale for the width is going to be alpha times m. The bound state was alpha strong times m.
Oh, we'll talk about this in a moment. Yeah, we are getting there, exactly.
Schematics, actually, it is selected for, right, the sort of selection that you use. So you think about when you're producing things.
Let's talk about scales. Like,
you basically are selecting for kinematics in the high peak for low rapidity region. But things that can get out there are things that are kind of boosted in the third place, right? So you produce these things generally on shell when they're heavy and with small relative velocities. And you win in the sense of the cuts you put on in the experiment selects for that kinematic region also. Kind of important.
Let's talk about the scales. We have a problem and to discuss in which situation indeed the bound states are broad or narrow. So the binding energy has the two powers of alpha s. On the other hand, annihilation rate, it has the alpha s squared from a typical strong production cross section at short distances times the square of the wave function at the origin. So overall, we have five powers of alpha s. So usually, bound states in which the decays are dominated by annihilation, they will be very narrow, much narrower than the binding energy. This is the first thing to notice here. But now, how about the decays of the single particles? So if the particles that bind can decay by these two-body decays with some strong interaction vertex, for example, a gluon that can decay into a squark and a quark, the decay rate will be very large. So it will be larger or comparable to the binding energy and much, much larger than the annihilation decays. So this is not a good situation to try to find the bound state signature. And of course, even if we have electroweak decays, like squarks that decay into a quark and a chargino or a neutralino, we still have this situation, like for the TT bar pair, in which the bound state is very broad compared to the binding energy. But in certain situations, the particle, for example, decays only through some on-shell, off-shell heavy particle. In this case, like, for example, happens to the gluino in the situation in which the squarks are heavier than the gluino. And when the squarks are heavier than the gluino, this type of decay is prohibited. And instead, the gluino decays into chargino or neutralino and the quarks through an off-shell squark. And the rate will generically look something like this, or for a particular case of the gluino, the expressions have this kind of form. And we see that even if these quarks are not too much heavier than the gluino, we still have big suppression for the Galileo decay rate because of this power of 4. And as a result, the annihilation decays of the Galileo can dominate. So soon, in a moment, we'll see particular examples of MSSM scenarios in which this happens.
So what sort of mass scale do you need with
this? Yeah, so you will see in a moment. You will see soon. Just the last general thing before we go to see this, we can ask, when we do have a bound state formation, what percentage of the pairs that are produced actually form bound state? And as a very rough estimate, we can estimate the ratio of the cross-section of the bound state and the continuum production by just taking into account only the parton level cross-section, integrating the parton level cross-section over energy. This is correct for the bound state. This is only a very rough approximation for the continuum because we haven't taken into account the fall-off of the parton distribution with energy. But if we just want to get something that doesn't really depend on the parton distributions, on whether it's quarks or gluons or anything else, I mean, this is the estimate that we have to do. And we see that it really depends on the cube of the color factor times the alpha s. And this will typically be a few percent. This will also be the case in some particular examples that we'll see in the following. Right? Here we just used dimensional analysis, more or less, for the continuum production. And we used this also as a standard thing for what we expect for bound state production.
Did you have to choose the range of integration over S there?
So I integrated it up to infinity. And,
So the numerator just comes in basically
at s equals 1
over 2.
In the denominator,
it's going like
1
over s.
Yes, I'm integrating it over root s.
You're saying that the integrated cross section would have been, if you integrated over s, then it's on the order of alpha squared over m? No,
alpha s squared over m, right? We have like 1 over root s squared. So yes, this is the estimate. This is a very rough estimate. So here we also have this alpha squared over m that will cancel. And here m cubed cancels 3 additional powers of m. And we have these factors of c cube, alpha is r cube. A pi, no, I didn't take the pi's into account because everything is very rough. And also I should say that not all the color configurations bind, so I should also divide by a factor of 2 or something like that. So it's just a very rough estimate to see what quantity actually determines how much bound states are produced. Yeah, but there are also all kinds of pi's here, and there are huge factors in the parton luminosity, so it will not be useful to include this 8 pi.
But the annihilations.
But you don't worry. I will show you exact numbers for particular things in a moment. This is just a general thing, just to show the order of magnitude of things in general. So now let's start discussing our particular example, which is the gluonium, bound state of 2 gluonium. We have 3 configurations that are attractive. We have singlet and 2 octets. The color factors C are 3 and 3 halves. These are diagrams for which 2 gluonium can annihilate into 2 gluons or into QQ bar pair. If you read these diagrams backwards, you also get the production diagrams for a gluonium pair. And when we are computing bound state process, we will also multiply all these diagrams by this wave function at the origin squared. And because the color factor there is 3, and we are taking third power, we'll get results that are rather large. If we are taking into account that gluonium are identical spin half Majorana fermions, we see that when the wave function in the color is symmetric, we must have the wave function anti-symmetric in spin, so we'll have spin zero. And the anti-symmetric configuration in color will be spin one. We can see which of these diagrams contributes in each case. A spin zero will be produced only from glu-glu, and spin one will be produced only from QQ bar. Spin zero will be produced only from glu-glu because in this diagram, the symmetric color wave function and the anti-symmetric vertex give zero. But in this diagram, we have suppression because of chiral symmetry. So only for heavy quarks, this diagram can give some contribution. And this diagram did contribute to an annihilation of a pair of gluinos into a TT bar pair. So the annihilation will be into gluons and also in TT bar. And we'll study these two channels. On the other hand, the spin 1 gluinonium will decay into a QQ bar pair, into all flavors of quarks, including TT bar. The particular expressions for the annihilation rates, for example, into gluons for these three color configurations, are given here. They just agree with the general expressions that I wrote before. We have some short distance factor times the wave function at the origin squared. The branching rate to TT bar depends on the quark masses. As I just said, the symmetric gluinonia can decay into TT bars through this diagram, but if the quark, or in particular in this case, we care about the stop, if the stop is very heavy, this branching ratio will go to zero. On the other hand, if the stop has a mass of the order of the mass of the gluino, the branching ratio will be of the order of several percent. If we're talking about light gluino, like several hundred GeV, it will be like 5%, or one TeV gluino, it will be like 0.5%. And as I mentioned, if all the quarks are very heavy, then there will be no branching ratio in TT bar. On the other hand, for the antisymmetric gluinonium, if the mass of the quarks are of the order of the mass of the gluino, the gluinonium is not produced at all because of destructive interference between these two diagrams. On the other hand, when the quarks are very heavy, like for example in the split SUSY scenario, then approximately 1/6 of this gluinonium will decay into TT bar. Of course, there are also various intermediate possibilities you can consider. You can have the top, the stop light and other quarks heavy or anything else, but I guess you get the idea. Let's now ask about particular MSSM models. In which of them are the bound states going to be relevant? So just some standard kind of benchmark points are the SPS points. Let me tell you what I have in this table. So first thing that I have here is twice the gluino width. And we see that there are two points in which the width of the gluino is much smaller compared to the other cases. This happens exactly because of what I said, that these kind of decays are prohibited, and then the gluino decays through this type of diagrams. What should these numbers be compared to? First of all, they should be compared to the binding energy of the bound states in the singlet and the oxid configuration. We see that these numbers are indeed much smaller than the binding energy. The second thing they should be compared to are the annihilation rates. And we indeed see that the decay rates of the single gluinos are much smaller than the annihilation rates here. Now, I should make a special comment about this anti-symmetric gluinonium. In all these models, the quarks have masses of the order of the mass of the gluino. And this destructive interference that I mentioned indeed cancels out much of the production cross-section for the anti-symmetric gluinonium, and you'll see the numbers here are very, very small because of this effect. Now, the particular models in which we will analyze are the following four toy models. In two of them, we take Gluino of mass 300 GeV, and in the others, 800 GeV. 300 GeV, because it's much easier to discover it, and it is not excluded yet. 800 GeV, because it is more similar to these benchmark points. In each of these two cases, we'll consider one-time situation in which the mass of all these quarks is like the mass of the Gluino, and situation in which all these quarks are much heavier, like in split supersymmetry. So what are the cross sections for this process at the LHC? For the 300 GeV Gluino, we see cross sections like 13 or 15 femtobarn in the digit channel, and smaller but still reasonable cross sections in the TT bar channel. The cross sections become much smaller for the 800 GeV Gluinonium. The zeros here are related to exactly what I just explained, that if the quarks are equal in mass to the Gluinos, there is destructive interference between the diagrams, and you don't produce the antisymmetric Gluinonium at all. But here we have, if the quarks are very heavy, then there is no branching ratio of the symmetric Gluinonia into TT bar. How do we simulate these things? So essentially, the only interactions that you can have, for example, of a singlet Gluinonium and a pair of gluons, this will be the interaction. Of course, you can think also about writing in terms of derivatives, but because we are interested in producing the bound state on shell, derivatives will turn into constants in the prefactor. And this is the coupling of the singlet Gluinonium into QQ bar. It is suppressed by the mass of the quark, as I mentioned, because of the helicity suppression. Similarly, we have for the octet, except that we have also some color factor here. And for the vector Gluinonium, we have this kind of coupling to the vector current of quarks. Now, in our simulation, we ignore the color factor just for simplicity in order to be able to simulate everything just within Pythia. We were able to simulate the 1 and the 8s Gluinonium by just modifying the pseudoscalar Higgs and simulating the vector Gluinonium by modifying the Z prime.
You're actually looking to see TT bar decays?
So we're going to look at these two channels, decays into digits and decays into TT bar.
So all of those, they're jet signals in the end, right?
So decays into digits, there are two jets, and TT bar, we'll discuss in more detail. I'll tell you what exactly we're looking at.
But you're always going to have the jet energy scale uncertainty.
Yes, yes, you will definitely have jet energy scale uncertainty will enter in the result.
Right. So can you see these things as they go into these colored final states that make jets just because of the energy scale uncertainty? So won't that make it, you know,
so the, our purpose
wash out any sort of feature that's much smaller than that, right?
The features will definitely be washed out, and not only because overall uncertainty in the jet scale, and even not only because of resolution uncertainty in the jet mass, but also because QCD radiation, right? When we produce two jets, there is so. But I will show you what we get, right? We get what we get.
Wouldn't you want to be? So, I thought you wanted to rely on sort of electroweak signatures. At least you mentioned annihilation. So is it just that those would be just so small for your states? That just
yeah. So when we're talking about bound states of two Gluinos, this signature, for example, in the gamma gamma signal, is very, very small because there are no tree diagrams for annihilation into gamma-gamma. But it will be possible for charged particles, like bound states of quarks, for example. Then there will exist the gamma-gamma signal.
Because I would say generically, any of these jet signature final states, finding these very thin resonances.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy.
It's not possible.
Yeah,
it's not easy,
as you will see.
It's not possible.
Well, I think under certain conditions it is possible, but it is going to be hard, yes.
So what are those conditions?
So now we'll do a specific analysis, right? So we have the digest signals from glue from this gluonium and QQBarf from the vector gluonium. And we have a lot of QCD background to that from elastic sketching of gluons or quark and gluon and so on. These are the two dominant processes. So these are the results of the simulation for 300 GeV gluino. The distribution here is normalized to 1 for each of the curves. So in practice, the background is much, much, much bigger than the signals. And in a moment, we'll see how much. But first, in this curve, we see that we have a peak in the invariant mass distribution. It corresponds to twice the mass of the gluino, a peak that is pretty broad because of QCD radiation. And there's also similar broadness that we haven't included here due to the resolution at the detectors. But still, this is much, it is a feature on top of the background. Now, to study the signal in more detail, we concentrate on this range of invariant mass. And we have distributions of PT and the sketching angle in the collision frame. So we can put some cuts on that. After these cuts, the signal has three sigma significance at about 10 inverse femtobarn, which is not too bad. The problem is, though, that the signal to background ratio is very small. It's about 0.1%. And so one would really need to know how to model the digest background well in order to be able to actually extract the signal from the data. If we go to 800 GeV gluonium, now the required luminosity becomes much worse. We could think about various ways to improve this. For example, maybe some methods that are presently under construction by various people of looking at the jet substructure in order to be able to distinguish, for example, between quark-initiated jets and gluon-initiated jets, or maybe some observables that will be sensitive to the colors of the color the representation of the digests, but probably that will not improve it very much. There are various differences that I don't know the details of, but if you look at, if you don't just look at how many jets you have and what the properties of the jet, but you also look at distribution of particles within the jet, then there are differences between quarks and gluons. But we haven't assumed anything like that because these things are not really developed yet.
By just eliminating one of your processes, that's what you're saying?
Oh, how it's going to help? Yes, yes, it's going to help by looking only on some subset of the process. For example, if we really will be able to know for each jet whether it's quark or gluon, then these huge contributions of background from quark gluon can be eliminated because we don't have any quark gluon coming from the bound states, just as an example. Or we could look for example, only a subset of the signal, and then we'll again be able to restrict the background to only a subset of the signal.
So in any of those scenarios, does that push the signal with the background up to like order one? Or?
No. It will not change these numbers very significantly. It can only change them a little bit. So I'm definitely not optimistic about the 800 GeV gluino, or 800 GeV gluino, which is 1.6 GeV gluino. A last comment about the digest channel is the following. If we look, for example, at the generic search for resonances in digest channel by CMS, we find the following curves. So these three curves correspond to 100 inverse picobarn, 1 femtobarn, and 10 inverse femtobarn. And this is the gluonium signal into digits as a function of the mass of the gluonium. We see that if we look at it this way, it's not very promising. But see what happens. At large masses, we indeed see that increasing the luminosity really helps improve the detection reach, and this 95% confidence level exclusion, this curve. But when we go for smaller masses, suddenly 10 units term to barn becomes the same as 1 unit term to barn. And here, 10 inverse term to barn becomes like 100 inverse pico barn. The reason for this is pre-scaling. The background, the QCD background, especially at lower values of PT, is too large for CMS and Atlas to be able to record all the events. And by default, they will be recording here, for example, only 1/10 of the events. And here, they will be recording 1 out of 100 events. But in principle, this doesn't need to be the case. As pointed in this CMS paper itself, even though not analyzed there in detail, if we know, for example, the mass of the resonance that we're trying to find, for example, if we will discover the gluino by the cascade decays first and we'll know what mass range we are looking for, we will be able to record more of the diode events corresponding to this massive range, or we can compromise on other triggers in various ways. And pre-scaling can be reduced very significantly. And if we do this kind of very naive extrapolation of the curves, as if we eliminate the pre-scaling, this really improves the situation. Now let's talk briefly about the TT-bar channel. In TT-bar channel, again, as I mentioned, we have a contribution from all the three types of gluonomia. And the background have all kinds of standard model processes. The analysis of this channel, like Mike asked what exactly we're going to look at. So the top can decay either into three jets or into a jet and leptons. And all these things will happen. And the question is what channel we want to look at. So if we are looking at a channel in which both tops in the TT-bar pair decay into leptons, then we'll have two neutrinos, and we won't be able to reconstruct the missing energy. On the other hand, if we are looking at this channel in which we produce only jets, this has large QCD background. And therefore, we'll be looking at a channel in which one of the tops decays this way and the other this way. And the channel in which a lepton is an electron or a muon because of the tau decays. I will not give you the details of the algorithm, but our algorithm is similar to algorithms used by Atlas and CMS. And this is the result. So similar to the Dyde channel, we also see the peak and the mass of the gluonium. If we try to see the signal relative to the background, we concentrate near the peak. And we again do cuts on the PT and the scattering angle in the collision frame. We get the following results. As I mentioned, the TT-bar channel is very sensitive to various quarks, are heavier than a gluino or of the same order of magnitude. And in this first case, when they're roughly degenerate with the gluino, we have 3 sigma significance at 500 in the femtobar. That's a large number, but not too bad. And hopefully, it can also be improved by some optimizations of the procedure. On the other hand, the signal-to-background ratio in this channel is much, much better than in the Dyde channel. We have a 2% signal-to-background ratio. On the other hand, in the situation of split SUSE, the signal is much smaller.
You always have a neutrino there.
So if I have only one neutrino, then I can reconstruct it by requiring the W to be on trail.
And so you're fully reconstructing this event?
I'm fully reconstructing this event. Some reconstruction is incorrect, but you see, this is what I get. As an input, I gave all the TT-bar production. PT produced all of TT-bar, and this is the result after our algorithm.
It's usually people aren't optimistic about that, like for the Higgs peak search with WW, as soon as you have a neutrino at stake. You're saying it's only
when we have only one neutrino, then
you're saying if there's one neutrino, you can do a full reconstruction.
Yeah, you can do a full reconstruction if you don't take the radiation into account. Once you include radiation, like we have included, then you don't always know which jet corresponds to what because you have more jets than you should have. But this is the result, including all these things. Of course, we lost a lot of the signal by doing various cuts and. But this is the final result, and I think it can be further improved.
If you could consider a lighter, you know, say 100 GeV, it's not really ruled out, right?
So I think you will need to do something special to the MSN spectrum to get 100 GB, but I think it will be much better.
So this channel would not be relevant, I guess, but the previous one, would it be
yeah, right.
Do you think it would be much better, or still not very optimistic for 100, say 100 GB?
Yeah, so as the mass of the gluon becomes lighter, the prospects for detection improve very significantly. You saw the difference between 300 and how bad it became at 100. Yes, but I just didn't want to go below 300 because I thought maybe you really need some fine tuning in order to get MSSM of that kind. OK, let's now discuss very fast the other bounce tests you can have in the MSSM. It will be very easy for us to do it because we already have the gluon-onion analysis, so we'll only need to compare the various things to the case of the gluon-onion. So let's consider the squarkonium. Squarkonium bounds set of a squark and an anti-squark, and has two serious problems. Problem one, the squarks usually decay too fast. For the gluino, we have a situation in which all the squarks are heavier than the gluino, a situation which happens in some of the SPS points, as I have shown you. And in this case, the gluino can be made arbitrarily stable, and we can talk about the bound states. Or even if the quarks are only a little bit heavier than the gluino, it's still sufficiently stable to talk about bound states. On the other hand, quarks can usually decay in this way, especially they can decay into quark and chargino or neutralino, and they decay too fast. I remind you that for the annihilation rates, we have 5 powers of alpha s here. A second problem for the squarks is their small color factor. As you may remember, the color factor enters in third power here. And if we compare, for example, the singlet gluonium to singlet squarkonium, this color factor makes a lot of difference. And the short distance part of the production also suffers from these different color factors. And overall, the annihilation rate, for example, of the singlet 2-glu-glu is different by a factor of about 200 if we assume the same mass for the squark and the gluino. And the same will happen to the production cross-sections, which are essentially determined by the same kind of matrix elements. So we have two serious problems for the squarkonium. However, in certain situations, we can give squarkonium a second chance. First of all, the exception to the large decay rate of the squarks is the lightest stop. The lightest stop can be sufficiently light in certain scenarios so that it cannot decay into a neutralino and a top. This is not generic in MSUGRA, but there are certain scenarios that are discussed in more detail in this literature that I cite here, in which the stoponium is very narrow, like the gluonium, and the annihilation decays dominate. The second problem of the small annihilation rates can also be avoided, in a sense, by looking at the gamma-gamma channel. Because unlike the gluonium, squarks are charged, they can annihilate into gamma-gamma. The annihilation to gamma-gamma has a very small branching ratio compared to the dominant annihilation into glu-glu, but the backgrounds in the gamma-gamma channel are much better. And as analyzed in these papers, you can see the stoponium in these models in a large range of parameters of these models for large luminosity. What about the other types of bound states in the MSSM? A bound state of a squark and a gluino, this one, or a bound state of two squarks. So they again have the problem, like the squarkonium, that the squarks here, or the two squarks here, decay too fast. But unfortunately, they don't have the solution of looking at the bound states that involve the stop. Because here, if you want to produce the stop, you need to start with a top, and there's no top in the PDFs. And similarly here. So we are not going to see bound states of these two types unless there's some really contrived scenario in which both the squarks and the gluinos are sufficiently stable. Finally, let me talk about a different scenario than MSSM. Of course, you can talk about scenarios that are a little bit different from the MSSM, in which you have some particles, you know, some different spectrum of colored particles, or maybe different spins. But it's not very interesting to discuss that in detail at the moment, because the same ideas will apply. But here's something slightly different than the MSSM. Suppose our colored particles are also charged under some new force. In the case where they were charged only by QCD, we had this attractive potential, and the fraction of bound state production was given by this expression. But if they're charged also some representation R of a new SUN group, for example, the coupling constant alpha n, then this factor of C alpha S bar in the potential would be replaced by the sum of factors corresponding to these two forces. And this will enhance the signal very, very dramatically. There are several reasons why this would enhance the signal. First of all, even if we assume that the color factor here and the coupling constant of the new group is the same as in QCD, we get a big enhancement because of the third power here. We also get an enhancement because of the multiplicity of the particles under the new gauge group. And we also get enhancement if we consider that the other sector is somewhat more strongly coupled than QCD. Even if the coupling constant in the new sector is still perturbative but larger than in QCD, again, because of the cube, you will get a huge enhancement. Or you can consider a color factor that is bigger. But here are some examples. And compared to the CMS search reach at 100 Inus picobarn, 95% exclusion and 5 sigma discovery, this is the original Gluinonian curve. And here we have three models in which new particles are charged under QCD in the same way as the gluinos, but they're also charged, for example, in this situation, under a fundamental representation of a new SU3 with coupling strength the same as in QCD. And here, the coupling strength is still the same, but it's an eigen representation of a new SU4. And here we have increased the coupling of this case by a factor of 3. And you see that this really increases the cross-section by orders of magnitude. Of course, there are various additional effects that need to be taken into account here. For example, the bound states, some of them may decay not only into the standard model, but also into the hidden sector. But again, if, for example, we assume that the hidden sector is the same as QCD, very roughly, half will go there and half will go there, but this will still be larger by orders of magnitude. We haven't really studied what this other sector could be and to what extent we can build such other sector with the huge signal and still consistent with various constraints and so on. But it looks like there's definitely a lot that can be done about it. Now I'm coming to the conclusions. So first, I have conclusions about MSSM and then more general conclusions. So in the MSSM, we saw that the gluinonium exists if the gluino is not too heavy compared to the lightest squark. And we studied the digit and the TT-bar channels, and we saw that the gluinonium can probably be detected if we're talking about gluinos with mass around like 300 GeV. But for this, we'll need to know how to model the background, especially in the digit signal. And we also had this pre-scaling issue in the digit signal that needs to be avoided. We saw that this toponium can only exist as a narrow bound state only in very special cases. But then it can be seen in a gamma-gamma channel, even though in digest and TT-bar channels, the cross-section will be too small. On the other hand, other flavors of the squarkonia, which are not this toponium, and the bound states of two squarks or a squark and a gluino, they are unlikely to exist, at least as long as we consider somewhat a generic MSSM spectrum. In more general conclusions, we have seen in this talk how we can start with some new physics model and go to experiment in the context of bound states. So we start with the colors and spins of particles that can bind, and maybe we also have some new forces between them, like I mentioned in the last slide. The spectrum of the model determines to what extent the particles are sufficiently stable to form bound states, and also determines some of the branching ratios and the mass of the particle. So the mass directly gives us a peak and the invariant mass distribution. So if we really see this peak, we'll be able to have kind of an independent measurement and pretty direct measurement of the mass of the particles that bind. And if we look at the cross sections for the various annihilation channels, we of course don't get any direct information about any of these things, but once you start with a different model, you will have different predictions for the cross sections. And also, once you are really able to see the signal, you may be able to look at the angular distribution of the annihilation products and determine the spin of the bound state. And the spin of the bound state is again determined by these things, so it will be possible to compare different models. That's it.
Scaling story there, and you say that they've got a problem, but if they know there's something there, they can fix it by changing the triggers. Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, so I can tell you in a bit more detail what this particular CMS node said. They said that if the mass of the resonance is known in advance, they can change the trigger such that the pre-scaling will be reduced by a factor of 10. And if they further do the analysis of the events only in the high-level trigger without recording the full event, then the prescaling can even be a factor of 1,000. At least this is what they say. So I would say this is somewhat optimistic and good enough for us.
Any other questions? Let's thank you again.
Thank you.